Happy New Year from Time Team.
Since we started the podcast, you've been thinking some big thoughts, and now it's time for some big responses.
Your questions answered on the Time Team podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams, Helen Geek, and we welcome back once again Time Team's Derek Pittman. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
It is our first episode of 2025 and we wanted to do something that we'd been meaning to do for a while, and that's get through a few more of the brilliant questions that you've been sending in via Patreon.
Yes, at the end of every podcast, Patreon supporters get the opportunity to ask me anything, and I'll do my very best to answer. We've had some really thought-provoking questions so far, such as whether our ancestors had an interest in indoor gardening or houseplants, how sites get covered over with soil, and whether the Romans used stairs. And we've been getting loads of these, so we're devoting this episode to answering a few more of them.
And Derek, you're here as well to help out with some of these. Remember, if you want to ask a question, Patreon is the way to do it. All the information that you need is at patreon.com/timeteamofficial. And if you go there now, by the way, you'll be able to actually watch this episode as well as listen to it, just to give you a little extra treat for Patreon members. Okay, ready to dive in. Here we go with question number one. And this, I guess, is about new technology. And this is something we get asked quite a bit on the Patreon questions. It comes in this question from Randy McElroy, who says, we are longtime Time Team enthusiasts and we've watched the recording of trenches over the years. Our question is, how will new technology change the process of recording trenches and finds? With photogrammetry, imaging and GPS, how are these things changing the process of recording, and how do you imagine that they'll change things in the future? And Anders as well has a similar question from the first episode of Time Team, says Anders, to the latest, there's been this tremendous evolution in the technology available. Ground radar has evolved, LiDAR has much better resolution, and metal detectors have better sensitivity. On the documentation side, you've got 3D scans, the handheld nuclear backscatter devices, which I've never heard of, and a whole range of specialized gadgets. While my guess, says Anders, is that the new technology mostly gives you help during and after an excavation, have you ever been in a situation where, in hindsight, it turned out to be a hindrance rather than a help? Anders will come back to that bit of the question in a second. But Derek, maybe I can come to you on this one and the new technology and how it's helping, and maybe where you see that new technology going in the future.
I guess first the answer is yes, new technology helps us immeasurably with things like recording, with prospection, with even characterizing archaeological remains. And I think that's where the technology is heading across the board, in that archaeologists are very good at finding things and they're very good at getting a sense of what things may be, but actually being able to use new technology and particularly non-invasive means to actually characterize what people did rather than just identify spaces and shapes in the landscape. We can do that to a point with things like geophysics already, and John's been doing that for years. But I think things like hyperspectral imagery, which can be linked to soil chemistry and things like that, could give us new ways of using technology, not just to identify archaeology, but understand what it is we're looking at.
And what do you think is, if there was one thing that you think a new technology, if it were to exist, would help you to do, what is it? Like, what's the missing piece at the moment that you think, oh, if only we had a machine that dot dot dot?
Oh, that's a great question. So when we think about geophysics, when we think about all of the brilliant work John's done over the years, the one question it often struggles to do, unless you find something massively diagnostic, is chronology. You can often see shapes, you can see overlaying features, you can see all of these complex traces of inhabitation and activity. But what you don't tend to get is the chronological, so the vertical resolution between them, to say what happened first, what happened next. And I'd love a bit of technology to allow us to do that non-invasively.
Helen?
I was just thinking about, I think it was once an April Fool where it was announced that someone had invented a ceramic detector. And Ooh. So now we would no longer have to wonder where to put a section across a ditch to get dating evidence. I have often wondered what life would be like if there was such a thing as a ceramic detector. So you knew where to dig to find the one thing that would date your feature. But something that would use something much more techie to get an absolute date rather than just the kind of relative date that you can get from pottery, that would be amazing. Yes, something that it would be along the lines of something like optically stimulated luminescence, I would guess, but to be able to do it remotely rather than actually taking the sample non-destructively, that would be incredible.
Like a field mass spectrometer, so you can do carbon dating in situ. Wouldn't that be lovely?
Oh, yes.
Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it? That would be really, really good.
The thing that I do worry about a bit, though, about being able to do all this very fast recording, is the amount of time that archaeology, in some ways, I think, ought to take. Part of the process is the slowness and the thinking. And to be out in the field doing things slowly, doing things minutely, gives you time to consider and let all the other thoughts come into your head. Whereas if you're just quickly zooming over and taking a photograph or whatever, and then you've got that image and you're back in the office trying to work out what it means, you don't allow your brain to kind of roam. You don't let that creativity come in. I think that worries me slightly about our reliance on technology.
Yeah, because this comes into Anders's question, doesn't it? Where he's saying, was there a time where in hindsight you thought, well, maybe we shouldn't have used the technology here. Maybe we should have done this the old fashioned way. And I guess that's one part of it. I wondered whether, I remember talking to Stuart about LiDAR, and he once said, well, sometimes people just sit in their office and they look at the LiDAR data and they think, oh my goodness, this is definitely XYZ. And then they get there and it's a pile of tires or something.
I think I'd echo that, and I'd echo what Helen said, but it's not necessarily the technology that's the problem. It's the over-reliance on it and the lack of investment or engagement with the more traditional recording skills. Because I think, as Stuart would say, in a landscape context, the going out and sketching some hashes on a piece of paper allows you to think about relationships. It allows you to think about structures in a way that just having an image of it doesn't. And similarly with, you can do a brilliant photogrammetric picture of a trench section, but to sit and draw the individual fills one by one, you get a genuine connection to that sequence of events, which I think you struggle to get if you just take a quick picture and move along.
Yes, it really makes you look hard at it, doesn't it? It's what I think the jargon is. It's a heuristic device, something that makes you think about it.
I think this fits in really well, actually, with the second question on the podcast, which I suppose asks the question, when do you need to decide when not to dig? It comes in from Graham. Hiya, Graham, who says, love the podcast. Thank you, Graham. Thank you very much for saying that. I've often wondered, says Graham, how do you know when to leave things alone for those that'll follow you? Tech moves forward, and sometimes I feel that as much as you want to get at a site, you do have to leave some things for those that'll follow you, for when the tech improves to a point that it can achieve what you currently can't. Think what was lost trying to unroll the Pompeii scrolls. That is a really, really good point, isn't it, Derek? That if you start using technology now and go in and cover everything, you might be sort of ruining that archaeology for the thing that gets invented in 25 years, 30 years, 100 years time that could have answered that question if only it had remained in the ground.
I think, yeah, it's a really interesting question, this, and I think a lot of archaeologists will agonise over the ethics of this an awful lot. And it's why a lot of excavation projects will only sample features, so they won't 100% excavate something, knowing that there could be a time in the future where better technology would help understand it. But I'm kind of reminded of a quote, and I think I saw it on Time Team, it may well have been Mick, in fact, who talked about archaeology not necessarily being about investigating those things that are only at risk, but protecting archaeology through knowledge. And quite often in investigating a site, in doing a targeted investigation or a small sample of excavation, you can identify the importance of something which then protects it in future from things like agriculture and building. And I think there's a real balance to be struck between understanding something enough to know it's important and worth saving for the future, and also not knowing anything about it, so it's at perpetual risk. So it's a real balance, and it's a very, very complicated one.
You can take this to an extreme where you become paralysed by thinking that people in the future are going to know so much more and be able to get so much more out of a site. But if we don't keep going, then A, our techniques will atrophy, and we'll get to the point where we can't actually do archaeology anymore if we're not actually doing it. You learn by doing it. But secondly, there's no guarantee that anybody in the future is actually going to be interested. We're interested in particular things now that I feel say more about our society than perhaps they do about the past sometimes. And that people may be interested in entirely different things, and we have to kind of keep going and recognise that there will be improvements in the future, but also remember that we're doing this for the people alive now, and the people alive now are interested in things. But having said that, which all sounds very grand and high flown and so on, there are often slightly more prosaic reasons for not doing something. So I think a lot of the time, if you don't have the time and you don't have the oomph to do a particular thing, you will often say, oh, well, I'll leave it for the future. And I think that's absolutely right, because it's much better to not do something that you feel it would be a stretch to do because you won't do it particularly well. Leave it. At the moment, my day job, working with the Treasure Act, we've got the most immense amount of treasure this year, more than ever before. And one of the things that I've got in at the moment is a piece of gold sheet, which is rolled up, and it looks very much like one of those. They're not common at all, but there are occasional pieces of gold sheet that are inscribed during the Roman period and then rolled up to hide the inscription. Now, we've been wondering about whether we should unroll it. What we have thought is that we haven't actually at the moment got the capacity to do this. But if we can acquire it for a museum, then it can be unrolled at some point in the future. Or then one of my colleagues said, or actually we could just leave it until we don't have to unroll it, until we can look at it through the roll. And that preserves its rolled up nature. So people will always be able to see that it's rolled up, but they will also know what it says.
Got a question for you now on a topic that is a very modern topic to be talking about and is unfortunately on a lot of our minds at the moment, and that's climate change. This has come in from Richard. Hi, Richard. He says, Helen previously mentioned that in her experience, digs were getting hotter. And I remember when we went to Sutton Hoo last year, it being blisteringly hot. What does archaeology tell us about the changing climate in the past? And Richard sort of references the Little Ice Age and that kind of thing, telling us about the changing climate in Europe in the Roman period. But what do we know about this? Helen, what's your thoughts? Because, I mean, the world is getting hotter.
Yes, absolutely. And this, the evidence of the world getting hotter is preserved in things like cores through ice. When small pieces of ice are deposited every year in the Arctic, they can preserve bubbles of air and all sorts of different kinds of evidence that can help you work that out. Another place that you can find these annual deposits is in at the bottom of lakes. For some reason, they're called varves, I think. You can take a core and you can look at them year by year to see the changing environment, and you can carbon date the organics within those so that you can date them. It's a very specialist area, and I don't know an awful lot about it. It's quite possible Derek might, but I suspect that the problem is that we may be taking the same evidence and arguing in different ways about it, because the British obsession with the weather means that we can never stop talking about it. There's lots and lots of kind of contextual information. Like, I began to be interested in this when I was at university because Anglo-Saxon poetry is always complaining about how freezing cold and frosty it is. You know, when Beowulf goes up to the lake, it's all surrounded by frost, and it seems like another world when it doesn't really snow very often anymore, and certainly you don't get whole months when lakes are surrounded with frost. So I found that it's not very accessible to the ordinary everyday archaeologist. But Derek, you know, you're not an ordinary everyday archaeologist. archaeologist, you're head of department at a huge department of archaeology. So what do you feel about it?
To be honest, my knowledge of climate and climate archaeology is not huge, but whenever anyone talks about the value of archaeology for the climate change debate and discussions around climate change, I think about a chap I did my PhD with, a chap called Toby Pillett. I don't know if you've ever come across him, Helen.
No.
A really interesting scholar who did some work looking at the relationship between weather, the experience of weather, and climate, this kind of macro historical event, this long ongoing thing. And his work involved looking at historic diary entries, daily entries around weather events, what was happening with weather on every given day, and comparing that with our scientific understanding of the climate of the time. And it was a really fascinating way, I thought, of linking how people experience the changing of a climate firsthand versus how scientists understand it over the long term. And I think, in a way, archaeologists could help communicate those issues to the wider public, in that everyone experiences weather, but they don't necessarily have a longer term feeling of a climatic shift. But it's the weather is the proxy, and the changing weather is the proxy, not day by day, but over a long period of time. And I think that's where archaeology can really help with the debate, by drawing links between individual human experience and wider kind of scientific interpretations of the climate.
And in terms of the climate change that's happening now, how is it affecting the modern archaeology that we're doing? And I'm just thinking of things like the permafrost in Siberia thawing, and there might be some archaeological treasures under there that we would be losing because that ice is melting and we'll have lost that. And things like peat bogs as well, and you know, the changing climate, meaning that the archaeology we have access to is becoming more difficult.
Yeah, I think that people, I was going to say people like Ötzi, but in a sense, Ötzi, the Iceman found in the Alps, he's an archaeological site in himself, and he was only preserved from the Neolithic because of the ice. Other sites, like, in inverted commas, like Lindau Man, are preserved because they're waterlogged in the peat. And every time something changes, every time a piece of archaeology is brought out of a stable environment, or the environment changes, it is vulnerable, and we're potentially losing something. So we do have to be aware that it's happening. But I think the thing that archaeology, for me, does the most to highlight is how different now, how extraordinarily different our life is now to what it was even 500 years ago. What the long-term nature of archaeology shows us is that people don't live in inflexible ways, because you have to be flexible because of climate change. So when people say, oh, well, the climate has changed in the past, you say, well, yes, it has, but say in the Mesolithic, people are moving around the landscape very freely. They're not owning pieces of land. They're not building a city by a coastline. And it provides a useful kind of counterbalance to those who think that climate change is something that's natural and we just have to deal with. Well, we can't deal with it in the way that we have been living for the last 200 years. Life has speeded up so much that the last 200 years feels like how it's always been, but it absolutely is not.
Yeah, and of course, the speed at which climate change is happening is far faster than it would have been for any of our ancestors who might have experienced a changing world as well. And you have all that to add on top of things as well.
I don't know, because what about at the end of the last ice age? What would life really have been like in the Mesolithic? How quickly did things change? I mean, I'm not sure if I hadn't been told that I would have noticed climate change. Even somebody living where floods are happening almost every year, you might think, well, it's just a blip. We need that information, and that, as Derek says, colours our view, our perceptions are so out of whack with the actual data, because as human beings, even though we think we live a long time, our lifespans are pretty short. And I realise that I started this sentence disagreeing with you, and I've ended this sentence agreeing with you, Martin.
Well, I'm all for that to happen more. That's great. This is the Time Team podcast, by the way. It's Martin Williams with you, alongside Dr. Helen Geek, of course, and Derek Pittman, who is joining us for this episode, answering your questions.
Professor Derek Pittman.
No prof yet.
Dr. Derek Pittman, certainly.
An associate prof, which I think means budget prof.
Sorry, Derek. I was being far too colloquial. I know I've got to be deferential to Helen, but, you know, to you, I can only apologise. I'm sorry. Lord and Lady. Lord and Lady of Archaeology. Let's move on and get another question. If you want to, by the way, because this is a special Time Team podcast, answering your Patreon questions. We love hearing from you, and we do this at the end of every single episode as we answer some Patreon questions. Well, Helen does anyway. And you can submit yours right now on Patreon. You go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial and it's all there for you. Let's move on to another question. It comes from Joe Woods, who says, what happens, and we get this, we hear this so many times, this question, and so let's clear this up right now. Joe says, what happens to all the finds after excavations? Are there ever too many finds? M. Richards also asks a similar question. I'd love to hear more about the conservation that goes on after the dig and how the various items are restored, the different conservation experts, and how long these processes take. So when you get something out of the ground on a Time Team dig, it goes onto one of those finds trays and then off it goes. What happens next then, Helen?
Well, all the finds have to be washed and they have to be marked so that if something goes wrong, we can track them back to their original excavation, so that there's a mark on each object, ideally. I think in some very large cases, they're not marked individually, but they're marked by bag, so that everything can be reassembled at any time in the future. The main thing, though, that happens is that they go to specialists who identify them and date them. They go to be drawn for the final report. Ultimately, once they've been looked at and all their information extracted, everything that we can do at the moment, they then go into museum stores. And this has proved incredibly important for finds that aren't really considered at the time. So if you talk to Jackie McKinley, she will tell you that cremated bone, which she spent her life studying, used to be thrown away because it was well known that nothing could be done with it. So cremated bone that was kept in museums has become so much more important because it's the only survivor of a whole class of find that was just discarded. So we tend to keep everything. Occasionally we weigh something like burnt flint, keep a record and discard it in a very controlled manner, but normally everything goes into a museum store. And Joe's question, are there ever too many finds? Well, yeah, that is something that has really been worrying us for some decades now. We have huge museum stores which contain vast quantities of archaeological material, and these potentially have all got more to tell us or to answer. They can be asked different questions of as our questions change. But is this sustainable? What will we be doing in 30 or 40 or 50 years' time? Can we carry on just storing everything? It's a question that's worrying a lot of people and more people as the years go on.
And can you digitise them? I guess that's the next thing, isn't it? If you make sort of digital versions of them, scan them using some sort of technology, you could keep some of these finds digitally.
It's an interesting question, that, because it almost goes back to the question we had earlier about when do you decide to dig or save something for the future? And the same applies to finds and retention policies, and the ethics and the choices around what is retained and what is not is as fundamental as to whether you dig or not. While digital facsimiles are a great way of sharing finds, they don't tend to capture the materiality of things. They don't capture the fabric of a bit of pottery, for example, which right now we can analyze using something like petrography really well, but in the future you may be able to use some other technique to analyze. So I think while digital offers some potential for finds, I don't think it would solve the problem, if it is a problem, of places having too much stuff.
And really it's a funding question. It's a resources question. If we want to keep this evidence that we have taken out of the ground, evidence of past human history, if we want to keep it to be able to ask other questions of it, then we have to put the money in.
A really fun question now from Andrew Kidd, and he says, here's a question following on from the pot plant topic. Now, this relates to something we were talking about on the podcast about whether or not people back in time used to keep plants in their house in pots, because somebody said, well, you don't ever come across plant pots. Like, how would you know if it was a plant pot? We were talking about that. At the Witch Farm dig, Rachel talked about boring holes in pots for water to flow through. But then there's also this idea of sand flowing through as a way of marking time. Was this common? And I think this is such a good question, because it's a wider question of how did they tell the time in the past? Because I'm thinking there's that, isn't there? There's sand flowing through a thing. There's the sun, of course, and marking the sun, and then you use the moon as well to work out the months. And then, you know, the seasons from the stars. There's lots of things like that where you could work out what the time is. But I guess you get there's various different techniques that people would have used.
It depends on when we're talking about, I think, doesn't it, Derek? It depends whether we're talking about prehistory or eras like the medieval period or the Roman period, where life is a bit more organised and you may have to be able to meet somebody or do something at a specific time. I'm conscious, having said that, I've rather written off the whole of prehistory. No doubt there were things like courts and religious ceremonies and so on that had to meet at a specific time to do something specific. But we know more about the places that have left writing. And we have writing that describes an awful lot of specific times. I mean, most notably for a medievalist like me, it's the monastic need to have a service at a particular time through the day and through the night. How did they know when was the right time to start ringing the bell to move everybody down from the dormitory, say, into the church? Although I have a whole book on the reckoning of time from the early medieval period, written by this very useful author who wrote a lot of books, called the Venerable Bede. He doesn't actually explain how you measure it. He talks about how you reckon it, how you know when there's a solstice and so on and so forth, and quite a lot of astronomical things. But the day-to-day nitty-gritty. And what do you think, Derek?
It's a really interesting question, isn't it? And I guess there's two ways you can look at it, because I think we, in a modern sense, have a very fixed perception of what time is, in terms of we have clocks, we have times, we have hours. And in a similar way that we understand space through maps and Google Maps or whatever other map services are available, the technologies we have shape how we understand something. And I can't help but think that, thinking more of prehistory here, the way in which time would be perceived and understood was probably much more organic, in a sense, much more related to, as you say, the sun coming up, the sun going down, measuring through water flow is one example, or sand flows, thinking more generally about time being a bit more flexible in a way. We have this perception that time is fixed and it has limits and boundaries, but it could well be quite relative as well. I will see you after we've done this. I will see you after the X has happened. All that said, then you get something in Greece like the Antikythera mechanism, which is obviously a sophisticated piece of timekeeping. So it's an interesting one, and one I considering time is at the very essence of what we do, I've not thought about it as much as maybe I should.
Yeah, that's a really good point with the Antikythera mechanism, because that is the only thing of its kind that survives, and it only survived because it was in a shipwreck. Mm. And we have a historical account. There were water clocks in the Arabic world, and we've got this historical account of the Caliph Harun al-Rashid. He gives a water clock to the Emperor Charlemagne in France in around 800 AD. I'm not aware of any of these water clocks, certainly in Europe, surviving. So something like that, it doesn't get lost, it doesn't get thrown away, it gets carefully dismantled, carefully melted down and reused or whatever. But the illustrations that we have of them seem to be rather like the Antikythera mechanism, very, very precise. And the water isn't just kind of randomly running out of something. It's not just like an hourglass. The weight of the water is providing the kind of like the battery for the clock, and they're very precise. And that probably says something about the difference between Charlemagne, who didn't have a water clock, his kingdom, and the Arabic caliphates and so on that did have water clocks and clearly needed them. I must say, these questions are so, they're so penetrating and they're so wide ranging that we tend to stay on the little tram lines of our speciality. And it's only when somebody asks an enormous question like this that you suddenly think, I've got to go and look at the Arabic world. I've got to take everything into account. I've got to think of prehistory and Africa and everywhere. And we're quite badly equipped to do that. Even if you spent your whole life as an archaeologist, you stay in your world, and these take us out of our worlds.
Would having the ability to better measure time have given a society an advantage? I mean, we know that it did for us in the modern world, in terms of, you know, you couldn't really very well run a train service if all your every single city had a different time, and sort of standardizing it was something that came with the railways, and that helped our society. But that's the very, very modern world. I'm talking about, you know, before that, when you didn't have the kind of the concept of a clock or anything like that that could accurately measure time. If you did have a way of doing it with some degree of accuracy, would that give you an advantage? I'm thinking maybe for trade, or maybe for sort of organizing battles against your enemies or something.
I don't know. I'm wondering whether for battles, whether it's a positive disadvantage to be interested in time, because if your enemy is a lot more fluid about time, you may be surprised. And if you are a bit precise about time, you will not be able to surprise your enemy. I'm just thinking, I know you asked about the distant past, but I'm just thinking about my grandfather's memoirs of the First World War, where he says that the Germans used to shell every 10 minutes. And so you got about, you know, 8.5 minutes to do some work and to sort things out before you knew the next lot were going to come over. And so you could actually get quite a lot done because they were too kind of stereotypically Germanic about their precision bombardments. But then that's only weapons. There might be aspects that, I mean, certainly our civilizations, our dominant civilizations now, are very keen on precision measurement of time. So presumably it does give you some kind of advantage.
I was just thinking with battles, you know, if you've had two tribes or, you know, groups that were geographically separated but were coordinating an attack on a third tribe. And if you said, well, you know, when this happens at this time that has been decided, somehow agreed, we will attack and you'll attack from the east and we'll attack from the west, that gives you a tactical advantage. Whereas if you didn't have an ability to tell the time, where you both knew the time was the same as one another, you wouldn't be able to do that.
It's an intriguing one. It's almost as if controlling or having a good measure of time allows you to control your time in a way. I mean, even if we take today, for example, we were due to meet at 2 o'clock. Before that, I had an hour of a meeting, then a different hour of a meeting, then a lecture first thing in the morning. I could plan to precision, so I could get a lot done in my day because I could plan my time accordingly. But if we were planning this podcast without clocks, without any digital means, we'd have to say, oh, I'll meet you around noon, and you might have to wait half an hour, wait an hour. There'd be a lot more wastage, I think, in terms of a clock-free zone. And I'm not sure whether that's a good or a bad thing, but
it's a slower pace of life, isn't it?
Yes, and that takes us back to that technology question. If you are living a slower pace of life, you may get less done in a way, but do you do a better job because you've got more space in your mind to think up new ideas?
You may be happier.
Yes, that's true.
Let's end on a question, I suppose, about time, in terms of we've looked to the past. Now let's look to the future for our final question. It comes from Namari, who says, my question is based on Stuart and his maps. Okay, what do the team think about the fact that life is increasingly digital? Do they think that maybe hundreds of years in the future, our documents and maps will be like a new Dark Ages, because they won't be on paper, you won't be able to physically get at them and access them? Is there going to be a big sort of information age gap in the records? It's true, isn't it? Because so much of the stuff that would tell you about what is going on with life right now is digital. I mean, obviously there's a lot of physical stuff too, but a lot of our information is now digital. If all of that were to disappear somehow, what would be the record, and how would you get that information back in a different way if you were an archaeologist looking back on our lives now?
This is a fantastic question, and I really want to jump in on this one because I've got I want to draw upon. The first one is, it reminds me a little bit of a book I read recently by Robert Harris called Second Sleep, and I won't make any spoilers about the book, but it explores the theme of a digital dark age quite nicely, I'll say that much. But it's also that there is issues here, and digital preservation is a hot topic in archaeology at the moment. I was chatting to a colleague recently who used to work for Epic Games and worked with Sketchfab, which is something we on Time Team use, and we share artifacts, 3D artifacts, with our Patreons via Sketchfab. Sketchfab has recently been converted into Fab, a new monetized system. And all of those many hundreds of artifacts that archaeologists have been putting 3D models of on Sketchfab over the years may well start to not be curated anymore. So we've almost been relying on a digital system that we have no agency or control over, and that record's going to vanish. And I think rolling that out over the entire digital age, there could be so much lost in terms of our record keeping, in terms of our histories. And if you were to look at it from an archaeological perspective in 2000 years time, it may be more akin to prehistoric archaeology than Anglo-Saxon or historic archaeology.
Yes, but won't that make the study of it so much more exciting? It'll be so much more mysterious. So many more stories could be told, because you won't know exactly what's the right answer.
Because I suppose it invites us to imagine what archaeological traces we're leaving as a society now. And what do you think, Derek, in 1,000 years' time, people will be digging up that will tell us about the lives that we lead right now?
The two dominant material types we've got are plastic and concrete, and they will last for a very long time. In terms of how people are understood, I would imagine if I was an alien archaeologist dropping down on Earth now, I'd be quite baffled by some of the material culture we use, the McDonald's cup culture that seems to be a global phenomenon and yet masks lots and lots of cultural and social variation around the world.
There are several novels that look back on our age from a kind of post-apocalyptic future where they are actively mining our remains. One that I'm very fond of is Ridley Walker, which even the language has changed in the novel of Ridley Walker, and it's quite difficult to understand. It's best to read it out loud. That is a kind of a simpler age, which is looking back to our more complicated age, with huge resources of iron in things like agricultural machinery and concrete and plastic and so on and so forth. I think that people will look back at us and think, gosh, we were so wasteful. And where did all the resource come from that allowed us to be so wasteful, certainly in the West? And of course, it's all because all energy on Earth comes from the sun. This is all locked up sunlight from millions and millions and millions of years. It's made the fossil fuels, and fossil fuel has whether it's in the form of coal and oil or whether it's in the form of fertilizer, that this fossil fuel has allowed us to live far beyond our means. And that's going to be so standout in the future. Nobody will be able to miss our horizon of the plastic age, will they?
In a way, though, you could argue a similar thing for the classical world. I excavated last summer on a site in Greece. We were finding ceramic by the wheelbarrow load, like a huge volume of resource. If you were to quantify the amount of fuel and clay that it would have needed to produce that much stuff, it must have been a similar to our own time, I guess, a time of great consumption and indulgence.
And that's presumably all based on human capital. It's all based on slavery.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Well, I was trying not to end on a topic like the end of the world and slavery, but that seems to be what's happened. So
Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I mean, that is all we have time for. Thank you so much. If you've submitted a question, we are going to have to do another one of these, I think, before too long, because they're really good fun.
Yeah, they're so good. It's such a good brain workout for us, I think. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, we're always so keen to hear from you, especially especially if you have a question, but even if you haven't, even if all you want to do is say hello. But of course, if you're a Patreon member, you can ask whatever you like. And that's one of the many perks you get for supporting the work we do here at Time Team. And your money will directly fund archaeology and education and community outreach, both here in the UK and around the world. And you can find out more about Patreon at patreon.com/timeteamofficial. That'll show you all about the exclusive videos and the extended interviews and the behind the scenes content that you can get access to by joining us.
Derek, thank you very much. Any big plans for 2025 you can reveal?
Ooh, lots of exciting things coming up. Some great Time Team digs, some big ones and some little ones. I'm very excited already about our summer field school. I love getting students out in the field and digging holes. Ultimately, I'm just counting down the days till summer now, Martin.
Oh, I don't blame you at all. I think we need summer to come pretty soon. That is it for this episode. Don't forget, by the way, to hit follow if you haven't already. Leave a 5-star rating, write a really nice review, comment if you can. Do it. Do it now.
And we'll see you very soon on the next edition of the Time Team podcast.
Bye-bye.